Hey there, Freedom Fighters. My name is Andrew Warner. I'm the founder of Mixergy, where I interview entrepreneurs about how they built their businesses. This is my first ever interview in my house. Joining me is an entrepreneur that I've known for a long time, TK Cater. He is the founder of ToutApp.
Yep.
I say still is because you sold the company. ToutApp, what was that one sentence that you gave me?
We're a sales engagement platform.
The way I always thought about ToutApp was that I need to send out email. I want to know if people are even freaking opening the email or are they ignoring it? If they're opening it, are they clicking the link? Are they going back and like opening and shutting it and opening and shutting it?
Yeah.
Is that an indication? I want to know what happens when I send out an email so that I can improve it.
Yeah.
Right? But you guys have expanded beyond that.
Yeah, that's how we got our start. The email tracking was a big part of it. And then we had the templates, which was stop writing the same email over and over, write better emails. And then we evolved into sales engagement, which was you're a lead, take 7 touches to get you to come to a meeting. How do I get a hold of you over phone, email, and LinkedIn and everything else?
Beyond the email, you want to make sure that salespeople can reach their targets. All right, I say still is because he did create it, but the company is sold. And the reason that I invited him here to do this interview is he did this very touching photo on social media of his stuff on Marketo's desk saying goodbye. And I thought, I don't know why I'm so moved by this. I'm not usually moved by goodbyes. This one was. I think it's because I've kind of known him. I've known his software. I've used it. And it's like, wow, what this guy has done. I want to find out about how he started the company, how he built it up, how he got customers, what he did when so many competitors came in, why he sold it, what happened after the sale, and a little bit about this new book called How to Punch the Sunday Jitters in the Face. Find out what that means thanks to 2 phenomenal sponsors, one of which you used.
Yeah.
For hiring developers, there's no better company than TopTal. And for doing your finances, doing your bookkeeping right, I've been freaking loving Pilot.com. I'll talk about those later. TK, tell me about the day. Do you remember the day when you closed the sale of your business?
I do, yeah.
What happened?
I was 3 weeks sleep deprived. So we were going through a 3-week due diligence process. It was a 360-point spreadsheet to go through it. The reason it was only 3 weeks was because we wanted to announce it at Marketo Marketing Nation Summit in front of 5,000 people. And the moment we closed the deal, we were in a conference room. It was me, Leo Choi, who was our VP of Biz Ops and Finance. Him and I were working the deal, and you're on this conference call, and there's like the people from Marketo, the people from Vista, the people from their law firm, the people from the accounting firm, the people, like I lost count. And there's just this one dude on the call, and they're like, all right, TK, do you agree with all the terms of the deal? I'm like, I do. And then the chief legal officer on the Marketo side, like, all right, Margo, do you agree to all the terms of the deal? And she's like, I do. And then I was like, all right, we're gonna release the funds. We're all done here. And there was a brief moment of pause. And I was like, did we just get married? Like, that's what it felt like. And then we put the thing on mute and we just went crazy.
It was incredible. And the funds are officially released when they say, do you say yes?
So everything, that's the moment, at least for our deal, that's sort of like, it was the moment where everything's signed, everything's good, everything's checked off. And it's like literally the last piece, which is when they wire everything, they just want to get on a call and make sure everyone's good. There's no outstanding issues. Okay. And we're a go. And that was when everything just kind of went into motion.
How much did you sell for?
I'd rather not talk about that. So here's the thing. It's an venture-backed business. You either hear about the billion-dollar exits or you don't. And ours was undisclosed, which basically puts in a zip code where it's like immaterial what the exact amount was.
Did you end up doing well financially from it?
In the long run, I did. By the time that we sold ToutApp, and then 18 months later, we sold Marketo, it worked out really well for myself and the team.
Because you ended up with shares of Marketo?
Yeah.
And then you worked for Marketo, which gave you more. And then Marketo went from what? The share prices went up and then the company sold?
Yeah, well, Marketo was private. It's owned by Vista. And Vista had taken Marketo public. And it was only a few months later, they brought in a new CEO. They were rebooting the whole executive team. And they bought ToutApp. And I joined the executive team then. And so ended up being an incredible experience and just like net positive for everyone.
So I don't want to give away too much of this story, but I want to acknowledge one of the difficult moments, and I know that there are several along the way.
Yeah.
The hug. Who was this? Where was this?
Well, ToutApp ended up being a good outcome for people involved, and then Marketo even better so.
But long before that,
there was a point that ToutApp almost died. Literally almost, like we were in a board meeting, And at the end of the board meeting, each of the board members gave me a hug. You have the board meeting and they're like, all right, good job. And they're running off to the next meeting. It's like, they literally gave me a hug and they're like, all right, well, just cut the company down to 15 people and good luck and we'll figure it out from there. And they just laughed. And an hour later, I found out my dad was in the ER. And it was like one of those like double whammy, like craziest day ever.
And how'd your dad do?
It worked out fine, like everything else does.
But basically, they're giving you a hug goodbye. We tried to make this a venture-backed firm. It's not scaled down. Enjoy it. And
it was one of those, we need to cut and just cut down to 15, become self-sustaining, and we'll figure it out from there type of thing.
Yeah. All right.
And we were at 80 people at the time, so that was going to be, like, insane.
I've got all these questions about did you cut or not, but you know what? Let's go back to your childhood. I want to go a little bit before Tout and then go into where Tout came from. The things that you did to get users to Tout, what happened that set you guys on this downward spiral, if it was a spiral, and then how'd you recover and why you sell. But we talked before we started about how even as a kid, you were entrepreneurial, and you told me about something that you did with MFC. What's MFC?
That's a blast from the past. So MFC is Microsoft Foundation Classes. So MFC is this like framework that Microsoft came up with that helped you build Windows applications. Like way back, I was like 14 years old.
Okay.
And when it came out, there weren't a lot of resources available online. So that was one of my first entrepreneurial things. I basically built a website that was like a community. It was like, here's all the different places you can go to, but it was like a Yahoo, but only for MFC. And because it was so young and it was so new and there weren't too much out there, like we became one of the top resources for MFC. You gave a search for MFC, like literally it would be the third result, whatever crazy web crawler you were using at that time.
And was it also community or just a link to all the resources?
It was basically a directory.
Okay.
And then it turned into a forum, and then it also had recommendations.
And the money for that, the revenue came from?
So Amazon Associates had just started, and as just like a Hail Mary, I put basically top five MFC books, just a little banner in the bottom, and I just literally had a picture of the top five books, and if you clicked on it, it would go to Amazon. And you know, if you sell books, you don't make a lot of money. What would happen was people would buy an MFC book. For whatever reason, they would then buy a Super Nintendo. And then so every quarter I would start getting these like commission checks that were like substantial amounts from Amazon, all because people were coming to this MFC side.
How substantial?
For a 14-year-old, it was probably like $1,000, $1,500 every quarter.
What do you think this says about you that as an early young teenager, you started this company?
I just hate inefficiencies.
And you started because you hated inefficiencies?
Yeah, I started because I'm like, I really want to use MFC. It's cool. And I can't find anything anywhere. So this is not how it should be. There should be a better way.
It wasn't that you saw a market. It's not that you were entrepreneurial. It's just, this is too inefficient. I got to fix this.
I think like that's always been the primary driver. And then once I caught the bug of like, if you solve a problem and it solves a problem for a massive number of people, then it's highly lucrative.
Okay.
I think that's when you discover entrepreneurship. But primarily, I've always been driven by like, this is a problem. Like even Tout, it started because I had the problem and I just needed to solve it for myself.
Let me come back to that in a moment. And I'm fascinated by problems as an origination of businesses. But I want to go to one other business, HipCal.
Yeah.
What was HipCal?
So HipCal was originally called My Pimp.
My Pimp?
Yeah, it's okay. My Pimp, P-I-M-P, Personal Information Management Portal.
Uh-huh.
It was like Web 2.0. This is 2006. It was one of the first online calendars. This is before Google Calendar came out. And it was not just a calendar and a notes app, but it was also a group calendar. So again, it started with this necessity. We were in a fraternity. And we had all these social events, we had all these classes, and you had to like put it in your calendar one at a time. So we built HipCal, which was your online calendar, plus you could subscribe to the fraternity's calendar and the classes calendar, and all those events would just come in automatically.
And then eventually Google started adding that with their Google Calendar, but this was way before it. You guys built it just as a fun project in your fraternity?
It started with, so I had like four other co-founders. It was in our fraternity, Garrett Heaton, Pete Curley, were the two that like really started it, and then the rest of us joined on. And it started as a class project, and then it was like, oh, this is a thing. And we always wanted to do a company, not a startup, mainly because we were in upstate New York. We didn't really know about startups. We didn't know about fundraising. We just wanted to build a company. And so we got together, took over a room in our fraternity and built it out, and went to thousands of users. It was an awesome experience.
You sold it to Plaxo.
Yeah.
I remember Plaxo as being the thing that would trigger 1,000 emails from 1,000 different friends saying,
yeah,
I need you to update your address book with me, and
yeah,
you'd be able to go and add your contact information. But then they would send messages to all the people who are in your address book saying, I need you to update your account.
Yeah, it was the original social network.
From Sean Parker, the first, I think, president of Facebook.
That's right.
The guy who's gone on to a lot of fame and fortune over the years. Did you get to actively sell it to him? Did you get to meet him?
No, Sean Parker was gone by the time Plaxo bought us. Mm. But his co-founders were there, Cam and Todd. And they were evolving the company, and they were building out an online Plaxo. So originally Plaxo started with email plugins, which is relevant for Toutapp. And they actually ended up buying us because they wanted to build out an online calendar as well.
And did that work out?
Yeah, it was great. We were graduating college, and it was between getting jobs at IBM and GE, which is where what we would have done. In fact, like the summer we did HipCal, I was supposed to show up for my second internship at GE, Water and Process Technologies. Like,
okay,
it does not get more exciting than that. And I literally canceled the day before and just did HipCal instead. So it was incredible. We were graduating and we got bought and we moved out to California. We got a house in Los Altos Hills and we commuted to work every day together and worked at Plaxo. It was amazing.
Really?
Yeah.
That does sound like a lot of fun. Did you have a personal life at that point?
I had a girlfriend at the time. But between graduating and moving cross country, like it didn't quite work out.
Why'd you end up at Bridgewater afterwards? It's an investment firm, right?
Public equity? Yeah. Bridgewater is a hedge fund. Ray Dalio, he came out with the book Principles. They recruited me from out of Plaxo. At that time, I didn't understand it at the time, but everyone wanted to be Facebook. So everyone, if you remember that, like 2006, 2007 period, Facebook was doing well, LinkedIn was doing well, everyone else wanted to be a social network. Mm-hmm. I didn't know how to articulate it back then, but now I can. Like, I didn't like B2C, I was like B2B.
Why not?
I didn't understand it. Like, I'm more of a business software guy. I'm more of a let's close deals kind of guy. Nada, we have a whole bunch of users, and
so
some of them will monetize.
I can't picture you being that way, because number one, the HipCal seems like a business to consumer product. Consumers were using it, right? Number two, you were going to go work for like a water thing, a GE?
GE Water and Process Technologies.
Yeah, which just makes me think, you don't look like a salespeople don't want to go and work for, do they? For GE Water and Process?
I mean, no, GE Water Process Technologies is fantastic, but like no one, I don't think once, unless you're mechanical engineer or electrical engineer, I think maybe you want to work there. I just loved businesses. I loved revenue. I loved understanding like what solutions you were creating, what problems you were solving. Whereas social networking and B2C was really more of a vice. It's like, how do you actually get people to not do work and go enjoy or go escape? And for me, like going back, like I like solving problems, and B2B is like solving problems. Whereas B2C is a lot more of pleasure and distraction and escapism.
Mind candy.
Exactly.
And
that didn't resonate with me. I don't think it's bad or good. Just like what you were interested in and driven
by. But then what did Bridgewater want with that? They were looking to invest in companies that were social networks of running social networks.
No, so gardening. Bridgewater was completely different. I was like, I don't quite understand Silicon Valley. I grew up in New York City, and I was all of a sudden living in Los Altos Hills, commuting to Mountain View, working there. And I'm like, I don't like this. Like, I miss the city, I miss the East Coast.
Yeah.
I didn't quite understand it. Everyone wanted to be a social networking company. So I'm like, maybe the Valley's not for me. And Bridgewater came along and they're like, look, we value engineers just as much as the finance people. We're first principles thinkers. We want you to come build software for us to help us trade better in the markets. And I'm like, and I get to learn about the economy and all this. And that's what really, and Bridgewater has a very unique culture. And that's what really drew me to them.
I read the book, The Principles, right? That's what it was called. It was fascinating. Did you work in the farm that he was talking about in the book?
The farm?
Yeah, he had like a farmhouse or something where people were working. Maybe that was a short period.
There's Nyala. Oh, no. So the farm, that was like their office number one.
Got it.
I joined when they were probably at about 200 people, 250 people.
Even that's fairly small. They always wanted to have, from what he described, a very family-like environment. It was him living in this farmhouse with people working there, and his kid would be on the potty, and somebody who's like an executive walks through and sees the kid peeing.
That was like super early days.
No, that's not it. But the other thing that I remember about them was everything is like an algorithm. Even the human mind should be thought about in a sense of like you would program a computer, the way you think. Because then when there's a problem, you don't think I screwed up. You think, what part of my logic needs to be adjusted, right?
Yeah, it's all about principles.
How did it play itself out when you were there day to day?
The way it played it out is like, typically, when you face a problem or a roadblock, the natural human reaction is, how do I solve this problem? The unnatural human reaction is to take a step back and ask, what is this problem indicative of? And what is the general class of problems that this represents? And given that general class of problems, what are the set of principles that I can establish so that whenever that permutation of problems come up, we will have a solution for it.
So then how did you do that? What's an example of how they did that in a more basic way?
It permeated pretty much everything, like from how you think about what the type of food that they should have to...
Yeah, let's talk about that. Something very basic like that.
Yeah.
I'll give you an example that I remember from the book. Maybe this will trigger something.
Yeah.
He had this problem where if somebody made a mistake, he wanted them to report it, to not shy away.
Right.
How do you get people to report mistakes when it's not in their best interest? And what he came up with was, he said, we don't want to reward people for saying that they made mistakes, because that's really just not creating a great culture and encouraging people to make more mistakes. I think the answer, if I remember right, was, we're going to have people report on the mistakes they made. If you don't report, then you could get fired. But by reporting, others can learn how they made the mistake and avoid it in the future.
Yeah, it's called an issues log.
So there's
there's a giant SharePoint list you logged into. Anytime something went wrong, you would write into the issues log on what went wrong.
And so would you do that even if it was like lunch or dinner that was misordered?
Yeah, absolutely. Like if lunch was terrible, you would go into the issues log and say lunch was terrible.
And then whose job was it to go and pick through all these different things? And
so every issue needs to be diagnosed. Also, whenever you log an issue, it needs to be rated in terms of impact on a scale of 1 to 5. Five is like, we're losing money and everything's like, this is terrible. 1 is like, this is not the biggest deal, but again, this is probably indicative of a bigger problem, therefore we should look into it. And so you have to actually, like, in order to file an issues log, it's not like a, probably not like a Slack channel today, like where you go like, this sucks. It's like, no, there's a specific, probably about 8 to 10 fields that you have to fill out to log that issue and classify that issue. And then the manager that's you have to always give a responsible party. So again, one of the principles is always have a responsible party. This should be a single throat to choke, and as he probably put in the book.
I don't remember that line.
That might have gotten. So I didn't read his book, but I had the wirebound version of Principles from my time there.
Which is how it started.
With handwritten notes. That's what they gave to every employee.
With handwritten, your handwritten notes.
My handwritten notes,
Everybody had it, and then was it something that he would iterate on?
You had to have it with you all the time. And in meetings, you could cite a principle if you were bringing up a point related to a principle that was being violated or needed to be applied.
The
time that I was there, he was actually solidifying all the principles. And so there would be, basically draft one got published, and then there was open debate about, debate me on which principle you agree with and disagree with. And it went through probably 2 or 3 iterations where he debated some and tweaked some, and then it got him like, all right, these are the principles.
I can't believe
we're going to operate on them. And the way the principles came to be, and I'm sure this is in the book as well, is, every single time, this is like it in play, every time he recognized a problem, took a step back, and figured, he would thumb down in his BlackBerry a principle that he like came up with because of that set of issues that he just dealt with.
So let's bring this back to like entrepreneurship and something more concrete.
Yeah.
Yesterday, I totally screwed up. You came to my house yesterday. I was out for a run. My wife was here. She was in her Birkenstocks and socks. That's how unprepared we were for people. And she says, Andrew, TK's here. Oh, no. So what I now have learned to do is not to like beat myself up the whole run. I tried to find a way to make it work yesterday. It didn't make sense. But what I wanted to do was come up with a way to fix this and keep it from happening again.
Right.
If we were going to go back to first principles, what would we do? Would I just like write a principle of no meeting happens without a calendar? But we did have a calendar invitation. It was just that mine was not the same as yours.
Right.
So how does this work?
Yeah. The way it works is you first ask. So key thing in diagnosis, when you're actually looking to understand a problem and get to the core of like what the problem, it always comes down to some character flaw that the responsible party has. So in this case, there's some character flaw that you have that caused this issue.
Okay.
And until you get down to a thing of Andrew tends to XYZ blank, and that is why this happened, you haven't gotten to a root cause and you haven't fully understood
so what principle that you can create. It's so hard for you to say character flaw because in my mind I go, I am so disciplined. I'm right up against my calendar.
Absolutely, yeah.
But I always will put that aside to try to understand what you're saying and see how I could apply it. And what that made me think is Andrew's character flaw is he only goes by what's in the calendar and has to live by the calendar. So right. Now that we've understood the character flaw, what do we do with that?
Yeah, there's a thing of, there's two things there. One is, can you actually improve on yourself in terms of that character flaw? Is there improvement there? And another thing is, can you build systems to address for that and catch that next time? And that's where this really comes in. Like, this is where principles come into play. And first, where you actually ask, like, okay, if the calendar is the source of truth and errors still happen, then is there a double check on the calendar that needs to happen?
Got it. So maybe what I would do is, let's think very simply again, entrepreneurs, a simple answer for entrepreneurs might be, I might need a zap that checks my calendar, or maybe we code something up that checks my calendar, and if there's something that doesn't have a person attached to it, then it's an error that should be triggered. And then the other thing I might do is, I guess that might be one. And basically you're sitting around and you're thinking this stuff through all the time.
Yep.
So it's not, I screwed up, I got, some things you let go, but it's not I screwed up. Okay, all right.
There's like another example, that like another way to think about it is, this is where it gets powerful, right? Do you fix the calendar? Do you do a zap? Or is there an elegant solution? Like, you know what, a week before, just send an email saying, hey, here's what I've got down on my calendar. Looking forward to it. And that way it forces the other person to also look at it. And it's like, well, that's not right. It's Monday, not Tuesday, or whatever it is. So that way you have a second source of truth that's verifying or communicating what you've got.
So here's what comes back to me from that. What I always have to come back to is, what's the principle so that I don't just solve this problem, but solve all related problems.
Right.
And one of the things might be always have a fail safe or something like that. Okay. That's helpful for me.
So there's a principle in the book called trust, but verify. And so that would be the principle that applies for you. It's like trust the calendar, but verify.
I know what it was. In that case, I can't do a million different things. I have to reduce what I do so that I have like an hour to digest this problem, fix it, and make sure it never happens again, so that the next guest has the perfect experience. And then if I'm going to do interviews in my house, I have to either commit to them or not do them. And then if I do, I need to have a place to record errors from it.
Yep. So
like, for example, I know you like tea. I need to have 5 different teas here. Right. If someone comes over and says, I need decaf tea, I need to make sure that we have decaf tea. If someone else comes in and says, I need coffee, we need a quick way to brew coffee. And it's all these things go into the process. But I could only do that if I care about a few processes.
Yep.
Okay.
And the magic there, I mean, for the entrepreneurs, it's like, you know, you roll out a release and something goes wrong. Most entrepreneurs are like, quickly fix it, solve the fire. Okay, we're good. Move on.
Yes.
The discipline comes and I've worked at Bridgewater. I've worked with Vista, I've worked with Enrisa. These are three, like, best VC firm, best hedge fund, best PE firm. The one common thing that all three of these firms have, world-class firms, best of the best, is that they actually set aside time to actually vet their principles. They each have principles and they look at that. And so the thing you said where, like, I should have an hour where I diagnose what happened. If entrepreneurs did that just like once a week, that would be a game changer for their businesses.
Yeah, we need to do that more. If I'm running marathons in other continents and I'm doing interviews, we need to have a breakdown when I come back of what happened, a postmortem on everything. Okay, let me talk about my first sponsor and then we'll get back into the rest of the story. My first sponsor is actually a company called, who do we go with first? Let's go with Pilot, because you don't know Pilot. I'm going to tell you about them.
Yeah.
I hate having individual bookkeepers. A lot of my friends do. The reason I don't like them is I don't like one person to be sick or one person to have another client who's more important or pulls them away because they're less important, but they're annoying. I just want to know. There's a company of people who handle it. Pilot said to me, Andrew, we have software that will suck in data from Stripe, suck in data from all these other sources that you have, credit cards, Chase, whatever. Everyone except Citibank's always a pain in the butt.
Right.
But if we'll suck it in. We'll organize it. Then a human being will go in and do it manually and make sure that it's all right. I said, leave me alone. I don't care. I've got this okay. I said, come on. And then Satchit said, Andrew, they want to buy an ad. Don't you want to do it? I go, no, I'm happy. I finally said, I got to get these people to just leave me alone. These people, not meaning Pilot. The people on my team would say, here, take money and go and do my books.
Right.
I gave them access. They did my books and I ignored them.
Right.
January 1st, Andrea, my assistant says, Andrew, you've got to I think we should get paid as a team using Pilot system. They put it into QuickBooks. It all works. It just makes sense. Okay, fine, I'm not arguing with you. Let's go do it. I looked at the books. Every detail was so right. I've never had anyone get
all the categorizations and everything.
Yeah, a few months, 2 months later, I'll give you an example of something that was brilliant. I usually wear beads. They must be on the table here. We decided on it as a team. They're in my pocket. I don't want to screw around with here, let me show you. Someone on my team said, we're going to sell these for $5. We got them coming in from this woman on Etsy. I'm going to sell them for $5 as a way of like starting a conversation about focus. I totally forgot about it. I look at my books. I go, what the hell is this revenue line? They understood, because they looked at Stripe, that we were selling beads. They understood that the beads said TrueMind beads with them. They understood that we had a TrueMind program associated with it. That 3 people or 10 people signed up for the TrueMind program, so they attributed the revenue to that. They created a whole other source so that they could combine the TrueMind
beads. That's awesome.
The whole freaking thing. I was in shock, and that's when I knew I did a great thing. So I said finally to them, okay, you've been wanting to sponsor us for about a year. We're gonna let you come in because you're just that good. And they said, great, but we don't want to sell. I go, what the hell? What is this? I said, Andrew, no one's going to just sign up and with a new bookkeeper. I said, then what do you want to do? I said, what we want to do is anyone who has a bookkeeping company who wants some feedback on their books, we'll give it to them. They'll see how we work. They'll see how we think will be useful when they're ready to change. Maybe a year later, when they're doing their taxes, they're frustrated. They'll remember Pilot's a good company. Anyone who's starting out, they're probably not ready for us. We'll get on a call with them. We'll talk to them about the mistakes that they should make, what works and what doesn't. When they're ready to hire a bookkeeper, they'll hire us.
Yeah.
And then if they use your special URL, we'll give you some discount. I actually don't have it in front of me, so I don't remember what the discount is. Frankly, they don't charge that much. The amount is not that significant. They're not giving you 50% off because it's all services with software, but a lot of services. So here's it is. If you're out there and you're starting a company and you want someone to help you think through how to do accounting properly, or if you have accounting done right and you want somebody to go over your books and give you feedback on what you could do to adjust it and make it better, what I want you to do is go to pilot.com/mixergy. Pilot, like the guy or the woman who will... I hardly ever see a female pilot. Anyway, there's a reason for that. I actually did a whole trivia thing on that. It has to do with how the Air Force recruits. Anyway, never mind. Pilot.com/Mixergy. They will go over your books with you. They'll go over your plan for your books. And then when you're ready to sign up, they'll give you a discount. Wow. Is it weird that I think this lavalier keeps pulling down my shirt and showing you way more chest hair than should be shown in an interview?
I think you're good.
All right. I'm figuring this out. When Heat and Shaw and I did this, all I kept hearing was rustling, rustling, rustling. I said, I gotta solve it. We solved that. But now I gotta
I'm also
think.
A very still person. I meditate, so.
Do you?
Yeah.
Why do you meditate?
It was started at Bridgewater. So Bridgewater, Ray did this program where he had been doing transcendental meditation for decades. And it cost $1,200 to learn. And he did a program where they opened up meditation rooms in every building, and they said, well, I'll pay for half and you pay for half, and if you finish the course, I'll reimburse you your half.
Wow, okay.
And that's when I picked up, so I've been practicing it for 9 years, and it just helps me be more still. I'm like kind of an anxious person. Socially, I get anxious, but transcendental meditation kind of just like eases that down.
Anxious over what? This kind of goes back to, I'm guessing this is the point in your life where you titled your book, How to Punch the Sunday Jitters in the Face.
Yeah.
Is this a point in your life where you wanted to start a company?
Yeah.
You were. And so your Sunday was what?
Sunday jitters kicks in right around like 3 p.m. You've had a good weekend, but then that's when you get like, either you like drank too much, spent too much, went out too much, or you feel unprepared for the week, or you literally are going into a situation on Monday that you're not happy about. And that's like the pit in your stomach. So that's how I describe it. And I started feeling like I loved being at Bridgewater, but I always knew I wanted to go back and build a company. And it was that angst, and it was a little bit of like, all right, where am I going? How do I do that? Where do I start? That's kind of when I started to, meditation definitely helped. In fact, the year I started meditating is the year I quit and started Tout.
And how did meditation play into that?
Meditation, the way I pitch, I've gotten countless people to take on transcendental meditation. Excuse me, sorry. That probably kills
you. Mike does need to have like a cough thing. So I don't cough much, but I do have a problem with like this constant need to with my nose, you know, and I hear that from podcasters. I used to hear much more than today.
Now you control it?
When I do it remotely, I have a mute button.
All right.
When I do interviews, I need a mute button on this freaking thing. I haven't found one of those yet.
Is that right?
That's the one thing. Anyway, sorry.
That giant red means record, not mute, then.
I was thinking what I could do is like disconnect it, but I know I'm
more you're fine.
Potentially not going to reconnect it.
You ever watch the movie The Matrix?
Mm-hmm.
So Neo, like when he first starts, he has these bullets coming at him. He doesn't even know what to do. By the end of it, he learns that he can actually stop the bullets, look at it sideways, and pick the one bullet he wants. That's what meditation does for your thoughts, and particularly transcendental meditation. So generally through my day, I would have so much coming my way, and I might like...
Like what? Like what would you, I was going to say around today, but let's take business. What are some of the issues that would have come up to you as you were starting Talent?
I mean, when you're a founder, there's no shortage of whether it's personnel, funding, is the product market fit right? Like, and then your fears, and there's imposter syndrome. All of that is coming at you all at once. And like even when I was starting Tout, I like built Tout, I've been working on a different project that didn't quite like fit the market. And there's still that feeling of like, I just left a great job like for this. Is this like big enough? Is this gonna be a thing? Those are all things that come at you like a billion miles per hour. And the thing that transcendental meditation taught me to do was just kind of stop a midair and figure out what is like the one thought that is the most important thought to focus on at any given moment. You train yourself to do that, basically.
Okay. Let's look at this. I'm guessing the company that the product that you didn't think was going to be the thing was Recommend, which then became Brain Trust.
Yeah, that's right.
Walk through. You did this great blog post. The reason I know this stuff is because I read it.
Yeah.
Just thinking through, here's the way I came from one product to the other. The original idea was what? Recommend.
The original idea was I need to find X. I want to buy a car. And so recommend me what you think I should buy. So normally we Google search like best blah, blah, blah. And you try and look at reviews and figure it out. You reverse engineer the data that's out there. And recommend was just recommend me what I should get. And that's what that product was.
And you would have sent it to strangers. They would have said, you know what? You need this car based on what you said.
The core thing around Recommend and Brain Trust was it was all about the 5 to 10 people you really trusted. So it was your core group of friends.
Even in the beginning, Recommend.
Even would recommend.
And then you said user voice nailed it.
I think, they nailed it because they just went more into what I was trying to do. I was still early in my discovery of what I really love working on. I was trying to do it within your personal friends. All I wanted was my brain trust. I knew that like there's like I read Napoleon Hill. He has the concept of a mastermind, and I'm like, I want my 5 people, and I want an easy way to go ping them on stuff and have some sort of real conversation about it. And that's essentially what Recommend and Brain Trust essentially was.
Okay, and then you eventually said, you know what? Maybe why don't I go to existing Brain Trust, like within a company? I'm guessing. So if there's someone within a company who says, I need a recommendation for where I should stay when I'm in Chicago.
Yep.
Other people at the company know your sensibility, know the price point.
Exactly.
You should be recommending.
You're right. There was a brief moment where it's like the recommend thing would be just completely open social and like anyone could recommend it. You just kind of put it in the ether. And then quickly I switched to like, it's you can't, like network problems are hard to solve. Back then even doubly so. And so I switched to like, let's just focus on the 5 to 10 people that you really trust and they understand your sensibilities exactly.
And it didn't work. Why? Why didn't this work even when you're thinking about existing groups?
I think that there's a couple of reasons. One, I was trying to build it as a bootstrapped business. And those kind of things are hard to build in a bootstrapped way because it was such a new way of, it was a collaboration software. It was with your close friends. And I was teetering between, is this for my personal friends or is this for business? Eventually we moved to business. We started getting paid customers. It kind of looked like an early version of Yammer, but I was also in like Greenwich, Connecticut. Like I was leaving Bridgewater. I had some consulting going on. I was working on this solo in my second bedroom. And I'm like, I don't know, this should exist in the world. I would like to use it at some point. So it was all theoretical and I didn't have the structure that you would have in say a Silicon Valley or now you have online to really like take that to the next level and scale it. And that's why I think if you pursued it and if I had continued on it, I think it could have gotten bigger, but I wasn't in an environment that that kind of idea could thrive. Some ideas take a bit of time to grow.
I feel like even if you were in the perfect environment, that's an idea that is not as big as Tout.
Yeah.
The revenue isn't there. The clear need for it isn't there. People need the have the problem, and then they disappear. Facebook could be better equipped to solve it the way that they do now, right? With the questions, am I right about that?
Classic. This is classic vitamin, not a painkiller.
Right. And so then you said I had my own personal problem that led to Tout. What was the problem?
The problem was I wanted to get more users for Brain Trust.
Haha, okay.
And I'm like, perfect. I know, I'm going to start emailing business owners and say, hey, don't you wish you had a Brain Trust? So I started emailing people and that started to work. Like people were like, oh yeah, I'll totally try out the trial. Like, let's go for it. And then I'm like, I hate inefficiencies. And I was literally like, I'm typing the same email over and over and I'm tweaking one thing or another. And so literally I copied the billing code and the homepage and the crux of Brain Trust to a new project and I built it for myself so I could like just type in a name and an email and I could click on the template that best fit that ideal customer profile and I would personalize it, I would hit send and then it would tell me like if they looked at it or not.
Okay, that makes a lot of sense. And you did this, I think in 3 days, you wrote this blog post that I don't have access to.
Yeah.
What was in the blog post? And then we'll get into why I don't have access.
The blog post was I did it in 3 days. Because I used Chargeify, I used SendGrid, I used Ruby on Rails, and the whole idea behind the blog post is like, you can build a SaaS app leveraging all these services, and you can build something that's revenue generating within a weekend. And that's what was like really powerful for me.
And the original thing just did templates within what, Gmail?
It did templates and tracking. You could not, it was text only emails. You couldn't even bold a word if you wanted to.
Okay.
And it was not integrated into any email tools. So it was just a standalone web app. We had not built any plugins or anything like
and
that.
And a user would have to give you their email address.
You would have to give your email and verify it. Just so I know that you're not faking
Got
someone.
It. So if I bring my Gmail, put it in, send it out. Did you get users for it?
Did I get users for
it? Yeah. Obviously you did, but in the beginning, was this when you started to say, all right, I'm going to go after integrations, I'm going to go after individuals? What's the first place where you got users?
Honestly, I launched it 2 days later. Within 2 days, like we had gotten featured in 37 Signals newsletter. We were number one in Hacker News, that blog post you were referencing, and people were signing up and was making money. The reason I knew it was making money was I had rigged it where every single time someone swiped a credit card, it would send me a text message. And I programmed the text message. You remember this app called Boxcar?
Yes.
Old school. So what you could do is receive notifications, but you could set up a different sound. So it would make the sound of a cash register.
Wow.
And so literally every single time someone swiped a credit card, so within 2 days, it was just generating money.
Wow.
And my original plan was, I'll charge $9 a month. But I was talking to some friends and they're like, just charge 30, because otherwise, it's like a dollar a day. They'll make more money if they use it. It's probably salespeople that like it, so whatever. And within 2 to 3 days, I just started making money. Even though it did that.
At 30 bucks?
At $30 a month.
I was looking at your early pricing.
You couldn't even bold the text.
Wow.
It was like the product market fit was that strong. And I'm an immigrant.
There it is.
The reason that's relevant is like, it came so quickly and so easily. I was like, this is not worth it. Like, this is too easy. And so I literally ignored Tout for like 4 months. I just made sure it just worked, the core version. People kept writing in on how much they love it. But I'm like, this is not a thing, this is a toy. And my prior co-founder, Pete, who I started HipCal with, he was texting me. He's like, you know, on one hand, you're trying to replace email with this brain trust thing. So people don't email their friends. They come to your thing to collaborate. No one cares. On the other hand, you made email a little bit better. You made a better email client for a specific purpose and they love it and they're paying you $30 a month. Why are you resisting it? And I was like, I just don't think it's big enough. And whereas brain trusting, you know, you whenever you're like...
Everyone in the world could need this and they make decisions all the
time. It'll transform the world. Like you get grandiose about your vision when you're an entrepreneur and sitting in a vacuum in Greenwich, Connecticut. And so finally, 6 months later, I said, you know what? Like, even if this is a toy, it's got traction. So just follow what the customers want and let's see where it takes us. And that's when I started to follow on Tout. And it wasn't even called Tout at first, it was called Pitch.
And the reason it's not called Pitch now is?
The other thing that happened within 2 days, in addition to people paying $30 a month, was we got a cease and desist order from some random company saying we have the trademark on Pitch app. So I'm like, look, we're 2 days in, this is a toy. So I went on thesaurus.com, typed in Pitch, and I had the domain register and the other thing. And you know, you name your company based on what domain you can get, really, like unless you got $1 million in funding already. And so toutapp.com was available, so I bought that and ran with it.
Yeah, now I've got my screenshot from the Internet Archive. You did have a free plan that allowed people to send up to 5 pitches per day. Oh, now I see like the old language is still in here.
Yeah.
5 pitches per day for free. Encourage all new users to start with this plan and feel how Tout works for them. And then for $30 a month, you could send up to 100 pitches per day. And you also offered, and this was bolded on your site, website-like analytics.
Right.
That means open and click rates.
Right.
And you did open rates with a pixel.
Yep.
Yeah. That's amazing. It's actually all the essential features in there. It's not like you said, it's just going to be templates. I'll figure out the rest later. This is phenomenal features.
I needed that so bad. Like I just backed myself into product market fit. It was all the right things in that one app that I built over weekend.
I don't think that this existed at the time. I remember when we first needed it.
Yeah, we were one of the first ones. Yeah.
Was there someone else before?
Not in this way. There were some, like you could send an email, you could kind of track it, but not in the, you send a bunch of emails, they need to be consistent with the best messaging, and you need to track what happens after you send it.
Yeah, there would be like little plugins that would tell you when somebody opened and clicked your email.
That's
but it
right.
was more like, I'm kind of needy to know if my boss opened it, not I'm doing this to a lot of people and I need to know about all of them.
That's right, the magic in it was when you picked a template, it would aggregate the stats. So as you use more of it, it started to tell you what messaging was getting you more engagement. And then all of a sudden, additional email you sent just got better and better.
HiRISE was not just, or 37 Signals they were called at the time, they ran a product called Basecamp, which is project management we use to run our company. They didn't just randomly include you in a newsletter. You did a little outreach, right? What was that?
Yeah, I used Tout to send them an email.
To just see, will they care about?
Yeah, I was like, hey, listen, every single one of your users uses your CRM and they need to email their prospects. So we integrated, what we did was we integrated it where you had a little bookmarklet. So if you're in a HiRISE page, you're looking at a lead, you hit that, a little pop-up would happen. It would pull the data from HiRISE and it'll pre-populate the name and email. So boom, like email with Tout, choose the template, tweak it, hit send. And I did a little demo and just attached it for them. And they were like, this is amazing. And they just featured
fantastic.
It right then and there.
That's fantastic. All right, let me talk about the second sponsor and then we'll come back and hear about some of the other things that you did to grow the user base. How are you doing on tea?
That's great.
Okay, damn it. Then I don't need to have like a teapot on my checklist. The second sponsor is TopTal for hiring developers. You told me before we started to use them. What did you use them for?
We reached a point with Tout where we needed to test out new features, but I didn't want to distract the core engineering team. So I had what I called my private army, and my private army was like 3 developers, front and back end, and a project manager. They would go test out different ideas.
And you would go get them from TopTal, and you say, I need these 3 developers, front and back end.
There was a team that was on the ready, and they would test out different ideas.
Like, what's an idea that you had tested?
We had one idea where we wanted to be able to create a meeting room for salespeople. So, salespeople send over a lot of presentations. And so you could do that with Tout, but we wanted it where they could interact with the person real time. So I send you a proposal and you're viewing it. We wanted to do it where like a little thing would come up and say, hey, by the way, if you have any questions, I'm here for you.
Ah, wow.
And we're like, and testing those kind of things
out.
You
didn't want your engineers to get distracted with that. You go to TopTal, they would do that. How did that feature work for you?
We didn't end up productizing it. That was one of the, it was an experiment where getting that to the core engineering team and then prioritizing that, like it was cool, but not enough to get it into the core. But it was phenomenal because otherwise we would have just wasted our core engineering hours.
Yeah.
Those guys were super talented also. I was very happy with them.
For anyone who wants to go hire developers, I feel like that's one of the best uses of TopTal, especially when you're getting started. You've got a product you need. You don't want to distract from the team. You go and have them do this. If you're out there and you're looking to hire developers, a great place to do it is not just TopTal.com, but TopTal.com/Mixergy. When you use that URL, by now you know, they're going to give you 80 hours of TopTal developer credit when you pay for your first 80 hours. In addition to a no-risk trial period. By the way, I talk too fast. I grew up in New York. I should say
TopTal. What part of New York?
I grew up in Queens.
Me too.
Where?
Flushing.
Me too. I actually grew up in Jamaica Estates, actually, which is pretty close.
Yeah.
179th Street F train. That's what I would take.
That was by the 7 train.
By the 7 train?
Main Street.
Main Street had... Franklin Avenue. Right. That's right, yeah. I used to go to Main Street a lot by Chinatown. If you keep going down far enough, you end up there. I hated it at the time. No, actually, I wanted to move to Manhattan. I was very happy when I finally moved in. I thought Queens was so much better than Brooklyn. And then I've gone back recently. Have you? They've lost so much.
You think they've lost? Queens is cool now.
There are parts of Queens that are cool. The parts where they were going to get the whole Amazon thing. That part got...
Yeah, Astoria, Long Island City.
Yeah. Used to see people like poop in the street. Right. Now it's... That's the place. My part, Jamaica Estates, I think, and I haven't been to Flushing, but Forest Hills, they're just not that exciting.
Interesting, huh?
They lost it in my mind.
I haven't been back recently. I mean, I always just end up in Manhattan and don't make it out beyond that, so.
I do it because I want to go back sometimes and just feel in my gut, in my brain, in my skin, how far I've come or how not far enough I've come. Do you do anything like that?
Yeah, having a constant is super important to me. Yeah, I was like, I go back to, I used to live in Coal Valley, so I'd go back there sometimes, just drive past by.
Oh, I love that area. Then what do you feel when you're there, when you're thinking back about your past?
I think that we tend to be so critical on ourselves today, but if you were to meet you from 5 years ago and that was a stranger having coffee with, they'd be so proud of you. And that's the thing that I try to remind myself of, like, no matter what, like, I feel like I want to be, like, as happy as you are, you always want to do more. You beat yourself up over it. I think high achievers do that. That's why you become entrepreneurs in a way. And having that constant reminds me just how far you've come. So you're not as mean to yourself.
I don't know. I find that that's kind of hard because didn't you dream that Tout was going to be a $1 billion company? And when you think back on where you were when you were building it up, you'd be proud of where you are, like head-wise, headspace. But
yeah,
wouldn't you say, man, I want it to be so much bigger. Why didn't I do this and all these other people are doing it?
Yeah, I think that I don't believe in regret. And the reason I don't believe in it is because it's a flawed concept. And the reason it's a flawed concept is whenever we have regret, you're like, I wish I hadn't done that. The universe is a very complicated multivariate equation, and regret is the type of thing where you assume you can change one variable and everything else will remain the same. And so why like that? So I'm just like, well, I don't even know what to regret.
I don't get. Yeah, that's a good way to think about regret. I don't get lost in regret. I get lost in, I wanted to be so much further always,
right?
No matter what. Is that the timer? Do you need to go?
Like 10, 15 minutes.
Okay.
Yeah.
I need to do that too. One of the things I need to do when I get into meetings with people, set a timer.
Right.
Because I get so lost in conversation that I forget I've got other stuff to do.
Yeah.
But what about that? Didn't you feel like, yes, you're doing well, but you had this dream, you came, you got money from Andreessen Horowitz.
Right.
They're not trying to make a thousandaire. They're not trying to make a millionaire. They want to have a $1 billion business, right?
Yeah.
And so, what do you feel about that? Be open.
I don't feel any regret because I'm...
Not regret, but do you feel a sense of, like, poor, when you compare yourself to where you wanted to be, how do you feel?
The thing is, well, the question becomes, where did I want to be?
Yeah, where did you want to be?
My goal for, when I started Tout, my goal was, I was a kid coming out of a hedge fund, and I'm like, I want to build an amazing company, I want to have amazing customers, I want to create something of value, and I want to be really excited coming into work every day. And I want to create, I want to have impact. Like, those are the kind of things I thought of. I didn't think of, I wanted wealth, and I wanted to be able to get to where being able to do whatever I wanted to do. Those were my parameters.
And very similar to 37 Signals, wanted to be bootstrap. You were actually proud. You were, before we started talking about Bootstrap and Proud, their series, that's your mentality. Where did you then change from saying, I wanted to do well, I want to be wealthy, yes, to I'm going to take on funding, and now I'm on this path where I need to be.
Tout was that big of an idea.
At what point did you get to the realization that it was going to be that?
Because every customer conversation and every quarter we went through, the idea got bigger on how much more we could do for our customers.
Like what? So I really love the product.
Yeah.
I used it when I was thinking through this True Mind concept. I wanted to understand why people cared about it. I would always sign up, use it for the thing that I was using as I was like promoting something and understanding.
Yeah.
And then once I got it, I would stop because I'm not a salesperson, right?
Right.
So I get the difference there. But I always saw it as just that. I didn't spend enough time with the product to think, here is the bigger vision for it.
Right.
How did you find the bigger vision beyond every salesperson needs to know open click rates and have simple
templates? I mean, so I would not have raised money if that's all it was. The vision for it was people communicate through workflows, and they pull in data from all different sources, look at that data, and then make decisions on what do I write to this person? How do I communicate with them? And they do it through multiple channels, particularly for salespeople, particularly for customer-facing people.
Uh-huh.
So the vision got bigger and bigger, not about email tracking or templates. Like, if you look at later archives, we stopped talking about those things. It got more about how do you engage with a customer and how to use the right content at the right time. How do you actually use the right messaging at the right time?
Beyond the sales message, beyond the one-off, I need somebody to open this and know if it works, it's how do I follow up and know that they care about the Giants? Is that it? And the Giants won?
There's a part of that, but there's also like they come back to me and they ask me these five questions. And like the question became like, can we put a red, yellow, green on that message saying, is this deal trending to close or not?
They would ask you about that?
No. We would start to predict those kind of things. Like, that's where the vision went.
But did the salespeople tell you, I need this? Or how did you understand this was a problem? How did you understand this was something anyone cared about?
Well, as you start to talk to, we had the users down. The users got what they wanted. They were like, I can send emails, I can get them back, I can touch them seven times.
And they don't have enough imagination to think beyond it.
That's right. But as with any B2B company, any enterprise company, you want to start actually getting the higher levels engaged. You want to get the VP of sales, the CEO, and you start to talk to them, you start to understand like what are the things they want to know about a deal beyond what just CRM does.
And what do they want to know?
They wanted to know, is the deal going to close or not? And they wanted to know, is the rep using their best practices? Did they actually do the things they're supposed to do in a deal? And so the vision gets bigger beyond just, did they open the email?
How did you know that? How did you know that they needed all that? How do you go from understanding your core problem and putting something in the world and recognizing other people have the problem enough that they're willing to pay for a solution to now going into the headspace of someone that you've never been in their shoes?
Yeah.
What'd you do to know that?
Part of it was when we at Tout, when I decided that we're going to raise money, like a Series A, 6 months before that, we decided that we're going to focus purely on salespeople and sales teams. Before that, we were like email productivity for everyone. Like a lot of people, biz dev people, PR people, teachers, they all need email tracking and templates. There was a moment, like literally I sat down, I'm like, if we're gonna focus on sales teams and sales people, that has to be a conscious decision, and I have to own it, and I have to go into it like loving it. And that was the moment where I actually committed to reading like 10 sales books, start talking to sales leaders. I started to actually get in on the sales calls. I started to join sales groups. I joined this thing called Sales Hackers, which became an entire conference.
I thought you basically helped create it. You were one of the first 10 people in the meetups for it.
Yeah, that's right.
Max Altucher told me. Yeah, you were the first sponsor of it.
I was, yeah.
So this was you saying, I'm going deep in that world, and then
I'm gonna own it. I'm gonna be the best. Like, I wanna just like live and breathe being in sales.
So then how did you understand their problems once you were there?
I think that,
Did you sit and do interviews? Did you just listen in?
I was the chief salesperson for Tout, so I was already in the role. I put myself in the role. And then on top of that, salespeople just love talking. And so I just took them out for drinks and we just talked through like how to use the product, but really tell me more about sales. sales as an art. And there's tons
and they
of
would
books.
Tell you, here's what my boss needs?
No, they would tell me how. You understand their workflow. Like, what do they do all day? What are they responsible for? And then you find the inefficiencies and figure out how software can eliminate that.
Do you have an example of a conversation that led you to?
Yeah, our most popular feature for Tout all time, and even the competitors today haven't truly replicated it, and I don't know why, was the live feed. And the live feed was this floating window that sat in the top left corner.
Uh-huh.
And in real time, it would show exactly what was going on, from opens, clicks, website visits, the reviewing slide number 5, in any event that you wanted to track. And then you hit it, and then it would give you the one-click action on what you want to take next. Now, no one asked for the live feed, even though every customer I ever visited, if you were on the sales floor, you would walk through, there were only 3 things on their screen: Salesforce, Gmail or Outlook, and the Tout live feed, all day long.
And the live feed just told them, someone just opened your email.
It's a real-time view of exactly what's going on.
All the people that they were messaging.
Exactly.
So they would know, oh, I can understand that. Yeah.
Even better, because I sent you a proposal. The live feed would tell me Andrew is on slide 5 of the proposal. You know, wow, what was next to it? There was a call button. You hit the call button, your phone would ring, my phone would ring, and we'd be connected right then and there. And the salesperson would just say, hey, I wanted to follow up on the proposal. Did you have a chance to look at it?
Anytime something like that would have any type of action that was significant,
yep,
when it showed on the live feed, there was, yep, one click that would call both of us so we could. And yep, so who invented that? Who knew that would be a thing?
I did.
And how did you know? Just because you were living and
you talking to a salesperson, all they ever say, you know what our number one feature request before the live feed was? Can you send me an email when someone opens my email? So I call up all these people, like, why do you want an email? Like, I want to know right away. What are you going to do with that? Like, I want to, if I know that they're looking at it, I want to call them. And so I'm like, well, what if we just told you they're looking at it with a call button? And they're like, oh, that sounds great. And I think that the key was to just map out their workflow. Like, what do you do then? What happens after that?
Wow.
And what I found, when you actually call up a customer, they do obscene things in their day jobs, like to actually get their jobs done. And if you can actually listen and say, how much of that can I automate or streamline into my workflow? Those are the kind of things that builds moats and stickiness in products.
Like what? What's an obscene thing?
I would say, all right, you're gonna call them. How do you call them? It's like, well, if you send me an email and they opened it, then I'm gonna go to my Salesforce.
Got
it. And we'll type in that name. I'm gonna type in that name and go to the record. Then I'm gonna like look at the phone number. I'm gonna type in the phone number in my phone, and then I'm gonna call them. And if they don't pick up, and then they keep asking, like, and then what? It's like, well, they might not pick up. I'm like, what happens then? It's like, well, then I got to go back into Salesforce and create a task to follow up with this person. I'm going to type in his name. I'm like, okay, you can get the task. Then what happens? So feature number 2 on the live feed was follow-ups. So it would literally, you hit another button and say, like, call this person in a week, and then it would just come together.
Wow-wee. Oh, that is amazing. Okay, I love that. As you're talking about it, I love it. I love sitting and talking to salespeople. I love watching it. I love the thoughts of inefficiencies. Did you get to a point where you said, I'm kind of tired of these people? I'm tired of sales because you're living it so much?
A little bit, yeah.
A little bit.
Yeah.
Towards the end?
I think that there was always a question in my mind of, is this the thing for me forever? And I think as entrepreneurs, like, I don't know about you, my dream as an entrepreneur now, like, this wasn't it at Tout. When I started Tout, it was like, I just want to build a company because I'd never done it before. My dream right now is to be able to work on something that I can work on for the next 20 to 30 years of my life. Like, I think that's like a blessing if you can get to that.
You know what? And I'm at that, and I hate that I love it so much. I feel like, boy, there's so much else you should be looking at. Why are you so deep in love with this? And I have to keep reminding myself, enjoy the fact that you're in love with this.
Yeah.
It's a gift that you're, but I do wrestle with that a lot. What got you to a place where you got those hugs? Why did you end up, considering how things were just growing and growing?
Yeah, 3 things happened. So we had raised our Series B. We raised about $15 million. It was great. And we pushed on the gas real hard, moved into much bigger space, scaled the sales team. During that year, because we had raised from a tier one firm, it was a hot space, literally like almost overnight, 3 of our customers became our competitors. Literally almost like, they were like, oh, this is awesome. We're gonna compete with you guys. SalesLoft, Outreach, and YesWare was always there. So those were our 3 big, and they're all still alive and they're going really well. Outreach is a unicorn.
But they were clients of yours, Outreach?
Outreach wasn't, but SalesLoft was. Yes, where it wasn't. There was, for Max and I were talking about it from Sales Hacker.
Because he sold his company to Outreach.
Company to Outreach. Those companies have people in leadership that were once customers of Tout. There's like this like island of loss where we all know each other type of thing. And so it got super competitive. And then when it came time for our next race, three things happened. One, our board member was leaving the firm. Two, the markets took a dive. And three, we were dealing with like just competitive headwinds where the conversation on what our customers wanted changed. It went from, I want to engage with customers to, I want to be able to send my customers as many emails and phone calls as possible. And that was what the evolution of that space turned into.
Why do they want to do more calls like that?
Volume is easier to do in sales teams to show more progress. And so it's easier to say I did 100 dials than to really personalize 10 dials and really hit it hard.
Okay. So then that's where it was. What did you do to turn things around when they hugged you, said cut down to 15?
I refused. And I was like, there's no way we can cut down to 15. And there's just no way that our customers would be screwed. Our product would be screwed. Like no one wins. And so through 2016, I re-architected the company. And I didn't know this at the time, but looking back, I basically applied a PE playbook to it where I...
PE?
Private equity playbook.
Oh, private equity playbook to it, okay.
To a venture capital company.
Okay.
And basically what I... Through the course... So I'll tell you the end result. The end result was we had our largest quarter in company history. We nearly quadrupled our ACVs. And then we sold. And we were like a few months away from cash flow breakeven. And this was... that was the after. And the before was we were burning $1 million a month to scale the company.
And so, yeah, what did the PE technique allow you to do?
Basically, number one was we figured out really, really who our most ideal customer was. We were in land grab mode. So when you're a VC company, your job is to put the money to work and deploy multiple bets. But when you're a PE company, your job is to strengthen the core. And so I said, what are our most profitable customers that don't leave, are most valued, and just make us healthy? And that was the higher end of the market for us. We were fortunate enough to have certain enterprise customers. And I said, let's just focus on those. And therefore, I actually ended up doing two layoffs. The first one was just to kind of clean out the company and get rid of underperformers, turn off certain bets, and get out of certain segments. We got out of SMB, we got out of the mid-market, and we just said, we're just gonna focus on enterprise. The second thing we did was raise prices. It was like a highlight meeting. It was like me, Ben Horowitz, Mark Andreessen, and one other advisor. Ben was like, you know, just raise prices. Like that works almost every time when you're like fixing problems. And for us, like we just set a floor, we will not sell a deal below this. And we did that, and immediately every deal was much more profitable for us.
And you didn't raise it on existing customers? It was just
new customers and on renewals.
By the way, I went to the website today. There's no longer a price list. It's, if you're interested, hit this button and come talk to us.
Yeah, you mean for TaoDap?
TaoDap, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, so today it's called Marketo Sales Connect, and it's generally sold alongside the engagement platform. And they tend to focus on like the deep enterprise, like 5,000 seat deals. They'll attach in Sales Connect.
Like to talk to Mark Andreessen, to Ben Horowitz, these superstars in entrepreneurship.
Incredible.
Were you able to sit there and actually have a conversation and be focused? Like you're on the level with it?
I mean, yes, you are, because I was able to, because I had spent by that time 5 years mentally processing this whole and calculating this whole space. And so I should be able to, and I was. And that's not the impressive part. The impressive part about those kind of people is that within 30 minutes of them getting a room, they'll spend 30 minutes asking a whole bunch of questions, and then there's always this moment where they go like this, and they're like, okay, got it. And then they're at your level. The 5 years you spend calculating all that, that's what makes them who they are. And then they're talking to you at your level. I'm like, okay, but then how do you think about this? And they're like, yeah, we thought about that, and you approach it this way. And when we show them roadmap, and it was just incredible conversations when we did have the opportunity to do it.
I've seen a few people do that. It is amazing.
Right.
It's like, they know the key things to ask, and yeah. Why'd you sell?
It was time. I mean, we turned around the company. So we weren't able to raise a Series C. And the board was like, we had a board member leaving, and the comps were all off. Like, and I pitched probably about 40 VC firms, and like literally through the court, and I pitched every single one. It was just not gonna happen. So I came back and I said, we're gonna fix this. And we did. And once we fixed it, then magically, like the investors were like, okay, so what do you want to do now? Like you, because 6 months ago, before I made all those changes, I said, here are the things I'm going to do. And they were like, still, we're not going to invest. And so literally there were certain investors like, you did everything you said you would do. And like we brought our burn down to like 100K. We were 6 millionaire, our business, 6.5. And there was that moment. And we actually had one investor that was like, hey, like I think we might be interested. And then our existing investors, we were like, hey, hang on, what do you want to do? Because we were starting to do sale conversations. So I brought my executive team who had gone through war with me. Uh-huh. And we talked about it. And I'm like, hey, listen, we were on a path where we decided we're going to fix the company. We're going to get it to like self-sustaining and we're going to exit it out because we think that's our best strategy to go win the market. What if we didn't? What if we went in another direction? And I looked around my team and they were all like, no, like this makes sense. And we signed on for it. And it makes sense to join a larger company and cede that to a much larger customer base instead of trying to go at it alone. So let's just go do that. And for me, I didn't see sales engagement for me getting to a company that would IPO. Now, others might do it, but not in the vision and in the way that I started. I started a company where we wanted to be the email client for salespeople.
Right.
I didn't want to build a company that helps spam people. And in a lot of ways, the market shrunk into, we want to just have our SDR, sales development reps, send as many emails and as many phone calls as they can to our list all day long. And I'm like, cool. That's awesome. I don't know what the value of that is going to be, and that may be $1 billion value, $10 billion value. That's not why I started the company. I started the company, and if you think back to the first version of TaoTap, type in the name and email, pick the template, personalize it, make it meaningful, and then hit send.
Yeah.
And over time, we evolved on that. And that was what was appealing to me. And given that that vision wasn't what the market was ready for, I'm like, let's just go join a larger company, seed it into the market, get an unfair advantage, and then go do bigger things. And that's how I looked at it. And we had two offers, very similar. Both companies did, I mean, Marketo obviously did phenomenally well. The other company is doing amazingly well. And I ended up choosing Marketo because it just made a lot more sense.
Because Marketo did this on a bigger scale. They were marketing automation for bigger companies. And it was like email and other stuff that they would, you'd get subscribers, customize it, send email out.
The, right? The story is perfect. Like Marketo helped you generate a whole bunch of leads under marketing. And then once a lead got hot, Marketo would send an email to the sales rep saying, hey, here's a hot lead. And our pitch was feed it into our system and the sales rep will then engage with that
lead. And send a personalized message and we'll make sure they follow up. Yeah.
And they'll also do the 10 touches if they want to, because we ended up building that feature because we had to stay alive. And so it was like a perfect thing. Steve Lucas joked on the when we sold the company, he came over like, well, we really wanted TK to join our team. I had to buy his company to get him, so we're really excited to be here. And I think he was probably half joking, but it worked out really well because that kicked off a whole second chapter. Like I ended up joining the executive team of Marketo, and like literally from day one after that, I worked less on TAD and worked more on like helping Marketo succeed, which was an incredible journey as well.
You told me before I started, you helped create Marketo Europe. You led it.
No, I didn't create it.
You did?
Marketo Europe was going strong, but they needed a new leader in there. So I spent 18 months there. I spent 3 months rebooting Europe, helping bring on a new leader there. And then I spent some time in Japan and then I like learned from them. I did like the product keynote in our marketing nation in Japan. And like, it's like, I think every marketer in Japan was in there. It was crazy. And I'm speaking in English, talking about Marketo's new engagement platform, and two ladies in the back are translating into Japanese in real time. It's crazy. And then, so I'd done Europe, did Japan, and then I came back, and like I had my one-on-one with Steve, and Steve was like, look, you don't have to. This has been like, normally founders take a break after selling the company, and I'd moved to Europe. And then I went to, and so he's like, look, you don't have to, but if you did, it would be really good for us. And so then I moved to Sydney after that and spent time there to help reboot that. And then I did M&A and worked on corporate strategy, and then obviously worked on the sale and partnerships as well. So it was like an incredible experience in that 18 months. And then we sold the company.
You're looking for the next thing right now?
Now I'm taking some time off. Okay. I just launched my book based on, like, basically after being a tech executive and a founder for 10 years, I learned a ton about how to get your mindset right, even when the things are really bad, like when you're doing layoffs, or things when things are really great. And so I wrote a book called How to Punch the Sunday Jitters in the Face. It's like essentially helps you get more centered and figure out how to operate better as an entrepreneur, as a CEO. So I'm spending time on that, spending time on my YouTube channel, Unstoppable.
Weren't you also, so I like that you've got in here, where was that? I just bought the book. Who sells a book for $2.95? What's up with that? Is that a thing? Is it because you're like testing it right now?
Books don't make any money. Books are designed to, like every CEO should write a book, is what I say.
And so why did you write this? Why do you think CEOs should write books?
Because the best way to build the brand of your company and get leads is to build a movement around what you're doing. And the best way to build a movement is to write a manifesto. And the best way to deploy a manifesto is through a book. So the book, I'll give away for free. Once you read the book, it actually teaches you certain concepts. One of the core concepts, there's two core concepts in there. One is Unstoppable Sundays. I spend every Sunday, 30 minutes when the jitters kick in to ask myself, where am I and what do I do next? And that actually is an online app that you can go sign up for and use.
Okay.
I also teach this thing called the 45-Day Beast Mode Challenge. Anytime we were stuck, slightly behind, I would rally my team and we would do a 45-day challenge. And we would accomplish incredible things.
Because doing the incredible things in 45 days does what to you?
Two things. Generally, when you are trying to do things that leave you neither here nor there, you only end up doing the most urgent tasks. You're spanning across personal and business life. When you do a beast mode challenge, you're focused on a singular goal and you create an action plan and you just like, and that's a thing, there's a name for it. And therefore you get to put in more into it.
I get it. I also feel like if I could achieve that big goal, then I feel more unstoppable in other things.
Exactly. Once you leave that 45-day challenge, you've trained your mind to constantly ask, what is the most highest impact task that I can work on? And therefore you leave the beast mode in an elevated state. And then you can chain beast modes. You can do like three or four throughout the course of the year to actually grow.
What's
as well.
An example of a beast mode that you guys did?
We were behind on a certain product and we did a 45-day beast mode to actually focus on that and nothing else and get it out so that customers would be happy.
What's one for your personal life? Do you do that?
Yeah, I'm down 35 pounds over the last 9 months. And the way I kicked the healthy habits was I said, I'm just going to do this for 45 days. And it wasn't anything crazy like keto or anything. I just counted calories and did jump roping. But I said, I'm going to do this for 45 days and it's going to be a singular area of focus for me and made the world a difference.
And you use the app to like keep track of your calories?
Yeah, the way Beast Mode works is you create an action plan, you commit to it. We also teach you how to have the conversation with friends and family. Mm-hmm. So if you're a doctor and you say, I have the boards coming up or I'm on rotation, everyone's gonna be super understanding, like, oh, got it. Like, I know you can't make it, totally understand. If you're an entrepreneur and you're like, I gotta work, they're like, well, you know, that's not cool, man. But if you say, I've got beast mode, and I'm working on beast mode, here's our thing, and we give you a script on how to do it, all of a sudden you're like a lawyer that needs to pass the bar, or like a doctor that needs to pass the board. You have social capital.
Should I just be looking in the book for beast mode?
Yeah, or you can go to getunstoppable.com. You can go to getunstoppable.com/beast-mode.
Okay.
And there's a guide for this. There's an Excel spreadsheet that helps you set it up. And there's a webinar where I explain my three secrets as well.
I had no idea you were doing this.
Yeah.
My brother used to go to bars a lot because he was in a place in his life where he wanted to take some time off. And he'd still want to eat healthy. And he'd ask for things like, give me just vegetables, some steamed vegetables. And they freaking slather the thing in oil and butter. And this ruined the whole thing.
Right.
And then he couldn't say I'm on a diet because that came across weird.
Yeah.
He discovered if he just says, I'm in training, can I have just steamed vegetables?
Exactly.
Even the dirtiest bars would understand just steamed vegetables, don't put butter, and it doesn't make you look
like. That got him social capital.
It's unreal how, and so from that I learned if you could just phrase it a certain way, but it's hard to come up with the phrasing, which is why I like that you're saying beast mode and here's the language for what to do.
Yeah.
I feel like it would rally other people around and help my wife understand why I'm not doing things for a bit.
The last piece of beast mode is you also commit on how you're going to celebrate, which is also because as entrepreneurs, we're terrible at celebrating. By the time we accomplish something, we move the goalpost already. And that's in the book as well.
I feel so much smaller. If I accomplished it, it is not big enough for me to care about. That's what it feels like, right?
Yeah.
I should only be excited.
You're already on to the next goal. You already forgot about it. Yeah, that's right. And so you actually write down how you're going to celebrate and how you're going to reward the people that supported you and celebrate with them. And that's part of how you have the conversation with them as well. So it's all structured.
You have a lot of these, like in the book, you have a lot of fill in the blank things.
Yeah.
Is that the way you think?
And also most personal development books yell at you for not knowing certain concepts. If you read my book, it's kind of like how I talk. It's like, look, man, there's one superpower I have. I take complex things and say, look, here's all you really need to know. I call it the hey man voice. And so the book is structured in a way where you can actually just answer certain questions that help you get to the mindset that you need to have. Instead of watching a video that says you should have a growth mindset or you should have a 5-year plan, and you're like, great, I don't know what that means and I suck. Versus it's like, answer these 5 questions and it'll actually help you get clarity into what you need to know.
I'm watching your levels, by the way. I love that I've got this right here. It's so helpful. For some reason, I associate this with you. Did you once only have calls on Thursdays?
Yeah.
You did.
Tuesdays work best was what it was.
Oh, was it?
Yeah.
So I do Thursdays because I thought you told me once you do it on Thursdays.
It doesn't matter when it is. It's just, it's got to be a day so you have it all.
I to this day, interviews Tuesdays and Wednesdays,
right.
Calls Thursdays.
That's awesome.
Anyone who wants it, just from that one little thing. And I have to admit, the first time you said it, I said, every freaking entrepreneur is a freaking life hack. I get it. That's the culture we're in. That's what they do. And then I went nuts with calls all over the place. It would interrupt my flow for something. Like even between interviews to have a conversation doesn't work. I said Thursdays. I even have like a acuity scheduling calendar link just for Thursdays.
Yep. It makes a huge. I could have nothing for the day but a 3 p.m. call. That first part of the day is smash for me. It would not work.
I don't know why. I don't know why.
I have no idea.
It does get me lost. All right. So is the best place for people to go, is it getunstoppable.com if they want to find out what you're up to today?
Yeah, go to getunstoppable.com.
Getunstoppable.com. Tout, we cannot sign up for anymore. I feel like we're way too small to sign up for it, but the software's so elegant. It was so well done. We didn't even get into how like you would teach people. You would offer these templates to get people to sign up. It was just freaking amazing. But I understand why you wouldn't. Well, you don't want us as a customer. We weren't spending that much money, and as soon as we understood our messaging, we would just stop.
Yeah.
And then we come back again. And it wasn't even me as a company signing up. It was every freaking person signed up for their own thing.
Yeah.
I get it.
Well, I mean, for that segment of the market, like outreach and sales loft are great for mid-market, lower enterprise. They're getting an enterprise as well. And if you want something that's like self-service, Persist IQ is great. And MixMax is great. And we did deals with them to make sure that part of the market had good places to go to as well.
What do you mean you did deals with them?
We offered, I reached out to CEO MixMax. I like what they've done with the product. And I said, hey, can you give a savings offer for the people that can't be on the self-serve anymore?
Got it, to switch them over. Yeah, I saw Sachit who sells ads for us. Again, everyone like picks their own thing, which is why you don't want to work with companies our size. And Sachit does use MixMax.
Yeah.
The only thing I don't like about it is the few people who still have the get MixMax on the email,
right?
That get rid of that. I don't need people to know that. I get it's great for MixMax that they're all promoting it. Every time they send an email out, it says sent with this, and it encourages people to open up the email and to click, because otherwise we'll know that you didn't. If we're the senders will know that you didn't. But I feel like our people should just pay whatever it costs, just get rid of that so that you're focused on the message, not distracting with the tool. Anyway, I've got a lot of thoughts about this. I'm so glad to hear how things are going with you. I've known you now, not like best buddies or anything, but you're in the startup space. I've watched you do things. You've been vocal. Even did a Q&A session for Mixer 2 years ago. It feels good to see that you did well. It felt so sad and also pride. I don't know why. I had nothing. I'm not your dad. We had nothing to do with this. but to just see you did a good job, you were able to put your stuff on the table and walk away. It reminded me of that old Vince Lombardi quote that I'll get wrong, which was just leave it all on the field, and you left it all on the field.
Yeah. Thank you. I appreciate that.
Congratulations. Thanks so much for doing this interview and coming in here.
Thanks for having me.
I messed up the URL for Top Tal because I got lost in the New York conversation. So I will say very slowly, top is on top of your head, tal is in talent. If you need to hire developers, go to toptal.com/MixerG. And MixerG, of course, is MixerGy. And if you need help with your books, meaning not writing a book, if you need somebody to help you with your accounting, go to pilot.com/MixerG. I wonder how much money they spent on Pilot. I bet he told me. We'll find out. All right.
Sounds awesome. So I need to look into it.
Doesn't it? All right.